been glad to go, but it was an added weight of loss in a small community, where death's depredations would never go unnoticed. And Henry was right. One always felt guilt. She wished she had taken more trouble with Ronald, had been kinder and more patient. The mental picture of him, half-stumbling from Surtees Cottage, was a burr in the mind not easily to be shaken off. And now there was the Archdeacon. Raphael's dislike of him was becoming obsessive, and it was more than dislike. There had been hatred in his voice. It wasn't an emotion that she had expected to find at St. Anselm's. She realized how much she had come to rely on these visits to the college. Familiar words from the prayer book floated into her mind. That peace which the world cannot give. But the peace had been broken in that image of a boy gasping open-mouthed for air and finding only the killing sand. And St. Anselm's was part of the world. The students might be ordinands and their teachers priests, but they were still men. The college might stand in defiant symbolic isolation between the sea and the acres of unpopulated headland, but the life within its walls was intense, tightly controlled, claustrophobic. What emotions might not flourish in that hothouse atmosphere? And what of Raphael, brought up motherless in this seclusive world, escaping only to the equally masculine and controlled life of prep and public school? Did he really have a vocation, or was he paying back an old debt in the only way he knew how? She found herself for the first time mentally criticizing the priests. Surely it should have occurred to them that Raphael should be trained at some other college. She had thought of Father Sebastian and Father Martin as possessing wisdom and goodness hardly comprehensible to those, like herself, who found in organized religion a structure for moral striving rather than the final repository of revealed truth. But she returned always to the same uncomfortable thought. The priests were still only men. A wind was rising. She could hear it now as a soft, irregular boom, hardly distinguishable from the louder boom of the sea. Mrs. Pilbeam said, "We're due for a high wind, but I doubt we'll get the worst of it before morning. Still, the night will be rough enough, I reckon." They drank their tea in silence. Then Mrs. Pilbeam said, "They're good lads, you know. All of them." "Yes," said Emma. "I know they are." And it seemed to her that it was she who was doing the comforting.
21. Father Sebastian didn't enjoy afternoon tea. He never ate cake and took the view that scones and sandwiches only spoiled his dinner. He thought it right to put in an appearance at 4 o'clock, when there were guests, but usually only stayed long enough to drink his 2 cups of Earl Grey with lemon and welcome any new arrivals. This Saturday he had left the greetings to Father Martin, but at 4:10 thought it would be courteous to put in an appearance. But he was only halfway down the stairs when he was met by the Archdeacon rushing up towards him. "Morel, I need to speak to you. In your office, please." And now what? Thought Father Sebastian wearily as he mounted the stairs behind the Archdeacon. Crampton took the stairs 2 at a time, and, once outside the office, seemed about to crash unceremoniously through the door. Father Sebastian, entering more quietly, invited him to take one of the chairs in front of the fire, but was ignored, and the two men stood facing each other so closely that Father Sebastian could smell the taint of sourness on the other's breath. He found himself forced to meet the glare of 2 blazing eyes, and was instantly and uncomfortably aware of every detail of Crampton's face. The 2 black hairs in the left nostril, the angry patches of red high on each cheekbone, and a crumb of what looked like buttered scone adhering to the edge of the mouth. He stood and watched while the Archdeacon took control of himself. When Crampton spoke, he was calmer, but the menace in his voice was unmistakable. "What is that police officer doing here? Who invited him?" "Commander Dalgliesh,"
I thought I explained. Not Dalgleish, Yarwood, Roger Yarwood.
Father Sebastian said calmly, Like yourself, Mr. Yarwood is a guest. He is a detective inspector of the Suffolk Constabulary and is taking a week's leave.
Was that your idea to have him here?
He's an occasional visitor and a welcome one. At present he's on sick leave. He wrote to ask if he could stay for a week. We like him and are glad to have him.
Yarwood was the police officer who investigated my wife's death. Are you seriously telling me that you didn't know?
How could I know, Archdeacon? How could any of us know? It wasn't something he would speak about. He comes here to get away from his work. I can see that it's distressing for you to find him here, and I'm sorry it should have happened. Obviously his presence brings back very unhappy memories, but it's an extraordinary coincidence, no more. They happen every day. Inspector Yarwood transferred to Suffolk from the Metropolitan Police 5 years ago, I believe. It must have been shortly after your wife's death. Father Sebastian avoided using the word suicide, but he knew that it hung unspoken between them. The tragedy of the Archdeacon's first wife was well known in clerical circles, as inevitably it would be. The Archdeacon said,
He must leave, of course. I'm not prepared to sit at dinner with him.
Father Sebastian was torn between a sympathy that was genuine, even if not strong enough to discomfort him, and a more personal emotion. He said,
I'm not prepared to tell him to go. As I've said, he's a guest here. Whatever memories he brings to mind for you, surely it's possible for two adult men to sit at the same dinner table without provoking outrage.
Outrage? I find the word appropriate.
Why should you be so angry, Archdeacon? Yarwood was doing his job. It wasn't personal between you. He made it personal from the first moment he appeared in the vicarage. That man more or less accused me of murder. He came day after day, even when I was at my most grieving and vulnerable, pestering me with questions, querying every little detail of my marriage, personal matters that were nothing to do with him, nothing. After the inquest and the verdict, I complained to the Met. I would have gone to the Police Complaints Authority, but I hardly expected them to take it seriously, and by then I was trying to put it behind me. But the Met did set up an inquiry and admitted that Yarwood had perhaps been overzealous.
Overzealous? Father Sebastian fell back on a familiar bromide. I suppose he thought he was doing his duty.
Duty? It was nothing to do with duty. He thought he could make a case and a reputation. It would have been quite a coup for him, wouldn't it? Local vicar accused of murdering his wife. Do you know what harm that kind of allegation could do in the diocese, in the parish? He tortured me and he enjoyed torturing me.
Father Sebastian found it difficult to reconcile this accusation with the Yarwood he knew. He was again aware of conflicting emotions. Sympathy for the Archdeacon, indecision whether or not to speak to Yarwood, concern not to worry unnecessarily a man he suspected was still fragile both physically and mentally, and the need to get through the weekend without antagonizing Crampton further. All these worries came incongruously and ludicrously together in the overriding question of the placement at dinner. He couldn't seat the two police officers together. They would want to avoid any obligation to engage in professional chat, and he certainly didn't want it at his dinner table. Father Sebastian never thought of the refectory at St. Anselm's in terms other than his dining hall, his dinner table. It was obvious that neither Raphael nor Father John could appropriately be seated either next to the Archdeacon or facing him. Clive Stannard was a dull guest at the best of times. He could hardly inflict him on Crampton or Dalgleish. He wished that his wife were alive and in residence. None of this would be happening if Veronica were alive. He felt a prick of resentment that she had so inconveniently left him. It was then that there was a knock on the door. Glad of any interruption, he called, Come, and Raphael entered. The Archdeacon took one look at him and said to Father Sebastian,
You'll see to it then, will you, Morel?
And went out. Father Sebastian, although glad of the interruption, was not in the mood to be welcoming, and his "What is it, Raphael?" was curt. "It's about Inspector Yarwood, Father. He'd prefer not to have dinner with the rest of us. He wonders if it's possible for him to have something in his room." "Is he ill?" "I don't think he's particularly well, but he didn't say anything about feeling ill. He saw the Archdeacon at tea, and I gather he doesn't want to encounter him again, if possible. He didn't stop to eat, so I followed him back to his room to see if he was all right."
"And did he tell you why he was upset?"
"Yes, Father, he did."
"He had no right to confide in you or anyone else here. It was unprofessional and unwise, and you should have stopped him."
"He didn't say very much, Father, but what he did say was interesting.
Whatever he said should have remained unspoken. You'd better see Mrs. Pilbeam and ask her to provide some dinner for him, soup and a salad, something like that."
"I think that's all he wants, Father. He said he'd like to be left alone." Father Sebastian wondered if he should speak to Yarwood, but decided against it. Perhaps what the man wanted, to be left alone, was the best course. The Archdeacon was due to leave next morning after an early breakfast, as he wanted to be back in his parish to preach at the 10:30 Sunday parish communion. He had hinted that someone of importance was to be in the congregation. With any luck, the two men need not see each other again. Wearily, the warden made his way down the stairs to the student's sitting room and his two cups of Earl Grey tea. 22. The refectory faced south and was almost a replica in size and style of the library, with the same barreled roof and an equal number of high, narrow windows, although these were devoid of figurative colored glass and held instead panes of delicate pale green with a design of grapes and vine leaves. The walls between them were brightened by three large pre-Raphaelite paintings, all the gift of the founder. One, by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, showed a girl with flaming red hair seated at a window and reading a book which, with imagination, could be construed as devotional. The second, by Edward Burne Jones, of three dark-haired girls dancing in a swirl of golden-brown silk under an orange tree, was frankly secular. And the third and largest, by William Holman Hunt, showed a priest outside a wattle chapel baptizing a group of ancient Britons. They were not pictures which Emma coveted, but she had no doubt they were a valuable part of the St. Anselm's heritage. The room itself had obviously been designed as a family dining room, but one, she thought, intended for ostentation rather than practicality or intimacy. Even the traditionally large Victorian family would surely feel isolated and discomforted by this monument to paternal grandeur. St. Anselm's had obviously made few changes in adapting the dining room for institutional use. The oval, carved oak table still held place in the center of the room, but had been lengthened in the middle by 6 feet of plain wood. The chairs, including the ornate armed carver, were obviously original, and in place of the customary hatch into the kitchen, the food was served from a long sideboard covered with a white cloth. Mrs. Pilbeam waited at table with the help of two ordinands, the students taking this duty in turn. The Pilbeams ate the same meal, but at the table in Mrs. Pilbeam's sitting room. Emma, on her first visit, had been intrigued by how well this eccentric arrangement worked. Mrs. Pilbeam seemed to know by instinct the exact moment when each course in the dining room was finished and made her appearance on time. No bells were rung, and the first and main courses were eaten in silence, while one of the ordinands read from a high desk to the left of the door. This duty, too, was taken in turn. The choice of subject was left to the ordinand, and the readings were not necessarily expected to be either from the Bible or from religious texts. During her visits, Emma had heard Henry Bloxham read from The Wasteland, Stephen Morby give a lively reading of a P.G. Woodhouse Mulliner short story, while Peter Buckhurst had chosen The Diary of a Nobody. The advantage of the system for Emma apart from the interest of the readings and the revelation of personal choice, was that she could enjoy Mrs. Pilbeam's excellent cooking without the need to make small talk, the ritual turn, to one side and the other. With Father Sebastian presiding, dinner at St. Anselm's had something of the formality of a private house. But when the reading and the first two courses were over, the previous silence seemed to facilitate conversation, which normally carried on happily while the reader caught up by taking his meal from the hot plate, and the company finally moved for coffee into the student's sitting room or through the south door into the courtyard. Often the talk carried on until it was time for Compline. After Compline, it was customary for ordinands to go to their own rooms and keep a silence. Although by tradition each student took the next vacant chair, Father Sebastian himself arranged the seating of the guests and staff. He had placed Archdeacon Crampton on his left, Emma beside him, with Father Martin on her other side. On his right was Commander Dalgleish, next to him Father Peregrine, and then Clive Stannart. George Gregory dined only occasionally in college, but tonight he was present, seated between Stannard and Stephen Morby. Emma had expected to see Inspector Yarwood, but he didn't arrive and no one commented on his absence. Father John did not appear. Three of the four students in residence took their places and, like the rest of the company, stood behind their chairs ready for grace. It was only then that Raphael entered, buttoning up his cassock. He muttered an apology and, opening the book he was carrying, took his place at the reading desk. Father Sebastian spoke a Latin grace, and there was a shuffling of chairs as they settled down to the first course. Taking her seat next to the archdeacon, Emma was aware of his physical nearness, as she guessed he was of hers. She knew instinctively that he was a man who responded to women with a strong, if suppressed, sexuality. He was as tall as Father Sebastian, but more sturdily built, broad-shouldered, bull-necked, and with strong, handsome features. His hair was almost black, the beard just beginning to fleck with grey, his eyes deep-set under brows so well-shaped that they could have been plucked. They gave a discordant hint of femininity to his dark, unsmiling masculinity. Father Sebastian had introduced him to Emma when they arrived in the dining room, and he had grasped her hand with a strength which conveyed no warmth and had met her gaze with a look of puzzled surprise, as if she were an enigma which it behooved him to solve before the dinner was over. The first course had already been set out, baked aubergines and peppers in olive oil. There was a subdued clatter of forks as they began to eat, and as if he were waiting for this signal, Raphael started to read. He said, as if announcing a lesson in church, "This is the first chapter of Anthony Trollope's Barchester Towers." It was a work with which Emma, who liked Victorian novels, was familiar, but she wondered why Raphael had chosen it. Ordinands did occasionally read from a novel, but it was more usual to choose a passage complete in itself. Raphael read well, and Emma found herself eating with almost over-fastidious slowness as her mind occupied itself with the setting and the story. St. Anselm's was an appropriate house in which to read Trollope. Under its cavernous arched roof, she could picture the bishop's bedroom in the palace at Barchester, and Archdeacon Grantly watching at his father's deathbed, knowing that if the old man lived until the government fell, as was hourly expected, he would have no hope of succeeding his father as bishop. It was a powerful passage, that proud, ambitious son sinking to his knees and praying that he might be forgiven the sin of wishing his father would die. The wind had been rising steadily since early evening. Now it was battering the house in great gusts, like bursts of gunfire. During the worst of each onslaught, Raphael would pause in his reading, like a lecturer waiting for quietness from an unruly class. In the lulls, his voice sounded unnaturally clear and portentous. Emma became aware that all movement had ceased from the dark figure beside her, She glanced at the Archdeacon's hands and saw that they were clenched round his knife and fork. Peter Buckhurst was silently circulating with the wine, but the Archdeacon clamped his hand over his glass, white-knuckled, so that Emma half expected it to smash under his palm. As she watched the hand, it seemed to loom and become almost monstrous in imagination, the black hairs erect along the ridge of the fingers. She was aware, too, that Commander Dalgleish, sitting opposite, had momentarily raised his eyes to the Archdeacon in a speculative glance. Emma couldn't believe that the tension, so strongly communicating itself to her from her companion, couldn't be felt by the whole table. But only Commander Dalgleish seemed aware of it. Gregory was eating in silence, but with evident satisfaction. He seldom looked up until Raphael began reading. Then he occasionally glanced at him with slightly quizzical amusement. Raphael's voice continued as Mrs. Pilbeam and Peter Buckhurst silently cleared the plates, and she brought in the main course. Cassoulet with boiled potatoes, carrots, and beans. The Archdeacon then made some attempt at recovery, but he ate almost nothing. At the end of the first two courses, which were to be followed by fruit and cheese and biscuits, Raphael closed the novel, went to the hot plate to collect his plate, and took his seat at the end of the table. It was then that Emma looked at Father Sebastian. His face was rigid, and he was staring down the table at Raphael, who, it seemed to Emma, was resolutely refusing to meet his eyes. No one seemed anxious to break the silence, until the Archdeacon, making an effort, turned to Emma and began a rather stilted conversation about her relationship with the college. When was she appointed? What was it that she taught? Did she find the students on the whole receptive? How did she personally think the teaching of English and religious verse related to the theological syllabus? She knew that he was trying to put her at ease, or at least making an attempt at conversation, but it sounded like an interrogation, and she was uncomfortably aware that in the silence his questions and her answers sounded unnaturally loud. Her eyes kept straying to Adam Dalgleish on the warden's right, to the dark head bent towards the fairer. They seemed to have plenty to talk about. Surely they wouldn't be discussing Ronald's death, not here at dinner. From time to time, she sensed Dalgleish's gaze fixed on her. Their eyes briefly met, and she turned quickly away, then was angry with herself for the moment's embarrassed gaucherie, and turned resolutely to endure the Archdeacon's curiosity. Finally they moved into the sitting room for coffee. But the change of venue did nothing to revive the conversation. It became a desultory exchange of platitudes, and long before it was time to get ready for Compline, the company broke up. Emma was one of the first to leave. Despite the storm, she felt the need for fresh air and exercise before bed. Tonight she would give Compline a miss. It was the first time in all her visits that she had felt so strongly the need to get free of the house. But when she left by the door leading to the south cloister, the force of the wind struck her like a physical blow. Soon it would be difficult to stand upright. This was not a night for a solitary walk on a headland that had suddenly become unfriendly. She wondered what Adam Dalgleish was doing. Probably he would feel it courteous to attend Compline. For her it would be work. There was always work, and an early bed. She walked along the dimly lit southern cloister to Ambrose and solitude. 23. It was 9:29, and Raphael, entering the sacristy last, found only Father Sebastian taking off his cloak before robing for the service. Raphael had his hand on the door leading into the church when Father Sebastian said, "Did you choose that chapter of Trollope deliberately to upset the Archdeacon?" "It's a chapter I'm fond of, Father. That proud, ambitious man actually kneeling by his father's bedside, facing his secret hope that the bishop will die in time. It's one of the most impressive chapters Trollope ever wrote.
I thought we might all appreciate it.
I'm not asking for a literary appreciation of Trollope. You haven't answered my question. Did you choose it to discomfort the Archdeacon?
Raphael said quietly.
Yes, Father, I did.
Presumably because of what you learned from Inspector Yarwood before dinner.
He was distressed.
The Archdeacon had more or less forced himself into Roger's room and confronted him. Roger blurted something out and told me afterwards that it was in confidence and that I must try to forget it.
And your method of forgetting was deliberately to select a chapter of prose that would not only be deeply upsetting to a guest in this house, but that would betray the fact that Inspector Yarwood had confided in you.
The passage, Father, wouldn't have been offensive to the Archdeacon unless what Roger told me was true.
I see. You were applying Hamlet. You created mischief, and you disobeyed my instructions about how you should behave to the Archdeacon while he was our guest. We have some thinking to do, you and I. I must consider whether I can in conscience recommend you for ordination. You must consider whether you are really suited to being a priest.
It was the first time Father Sebastian put into words the doubt which he had hardly dared acknowledge, even in thought. He made himself look into Raphael's eyes while he waited for a response. Raphael said quietly, "But have we really any choice, Father? Either of us?" What surprised Father Sebastian was not the reply, but the tone in which it was spoken. He heard in Raphael's voice what he saw also in his eyes. Not defiance, not a challenge to his authority, not even the usual note of ironic detachment, but something more disturbing and painful. A trace of sad resignation which was, at the same time, a cry for help. Without speaking, Father Sebastian finished robing, then waited for Raphael to open the sacristy door for him, and followed him into the candle-lit gloom of the church.
24. Dalgleish was the only member of the congregation at Compline. He seated himself halfway down the right aisle, and watched as Henry Bloxham, wearing a white surplice, lit two candles on the altar and the row of candles in their glass shades along the choir stalls. Henry had shot back the bolts of the great south door before Dalgleish's arrival, and Dalgleish sat quietly, expecting to hear at his back the grinding creak of its opening. But neither Emma nor any of the staff or visitors arrived. The church was dimly lit, and he sat alone in a concentrated calm, in which the tumult of the storm seemed so distant that it was part of another reality. Finally, Henry switched on the light over the altar, and the Van der Weyden stained the still air with light. Henry genuflected before the altar and returned to the sacristy. 2 minutes later, the four resident priests entered, followed by the ordinands and the archdeacon. The white-surpliced figures, moving almost silently, took their places with an unhurried dignity, and Father Sebastian's voice broke the silence with the first prayer. "The Lord Almighty grant us a quiet night and a perfect end. Amen." The service was sung in plain song, and with a perfection born of practice and familiarity. Dalgleish stood or knelt as appropriate and joined in the responses. He had no wish to play the part of a voyeur. He put all thoughts of Ronald Treves and of death out of his mind. He was not here as a police officer. He was required to bring nothing with him but the acquiescence of the heart. After the final collect, but before the blessing, the archdeacon moved from his stall to deliver the homily. He chose to stand in front of the altar rail, rather than to move down to the pulpit or reading desk. Dalgleish reflected that it was just as well, since otherwise he would be preaching to a congregation of one, and almost certainly to the person he was least concerned to address. The homily was short, less than 6 minutes, but it was powerful and quietly delivered,
as if the Archdeacon were aware that unwelcome words gained in intensity, if softly spoken. He stood there dark and bearded, like an Old Testament prophet, while his surpliced audience sat, their eyes not turning to him, as still as if they were images in stone. The theme of the homily was Christian discipleship in the modern world, and it was an attack on nearly everything for which St. Anselm's had stood for over 100 years, and on everything Father Sebastian valued. The message was unambiguous. The Church could not survive to serve the needs of a violent, troubled, and increasingly unbelieving century unless it returned to the fundamentals of the faith. Modern discipleship was not a matter of indulgence in archaic if beautiful language, in which words more often obscured than affirmed the reality of faith. There was a temptation to overvalue intelligence and intellectual achievement so that theology became a philosophical exercise in justifying skepticism. Equally seductive was an overemphasis on ceremony, vestments, and disputed points of procedure, an obsession with competitive musical excellence which too often transformed a church service into a public performance. The Church was not a social organization within which the comfortable middle class could satisfy its craving for beauty, order, nostalgia, and the illusion of spirituality. Only by a return to the truth of the gospel could the Church hope to meet the needs of the modern world. At the end of the homily, the Archdeacon returned to his stall, and the ordinands and priests knelt while Father Sebastian spoke the final blessing. After the small procession had left the church, Henry returned to extinguish the candles and switch off the altar light. Then he came down to the south door to say a courteous good night to Dalgleish and to lock the door behind him. Except for those two words, neither spoke. As he heard the rasp of the iron, Dalgleish felt that he was being permanently shut out from something which he had never fully understood or accepted, and which was now being finally bolted against him. Sheltered by the cloister from the full force of the gale, he made his way along the few yards from the church door to Jerome and bed. Book 2. Death of an Archdeacon. 1. The Archdeacon didn't loiter after Compline. He and Father Sebastian disrobed in silence in the sacristy, and he said a curt good night before stepping out into the windswept cloister. The courtyard was a vortex of sound and fury. An early rain had ceased, but the strong southeaster, rising in strength, gusted and whirled about the horse chestnut, set a hissing among the high leaves, and bent the great boughs so that they rose and fell with the majestic slowness of a funeral dance. Frailer branches and twigs snapped off and fell like the sticks of spent fireworks on the cobbles. The south cloister was still clear, but the fallen leaves, rolling and twisting across the courtyard, were already piling in a damp mush against the sacristy door and the wall of the north cloister. At the entrance to the college, the Archdeacon scraped free the few leafy skeletons plastered against the sole and the toe of his black shoes, and moved through the cloakroom into the hall. Despite the violence of the storm, the house was strangely silent. He wondered whether the four priests were still in the church or sacristy, perhaps holding an indignant meeting about his homily. The ordinands, he assumed, had gone to their rooms. There was something unusual, almost ominous, in the calm and faintly pungent air. It wasn't yet 10:30. He felt restless and disinclined for so early a night, but the outside exercise he had suddenly craved seemed impracticable and even dangerous in the darkness and the force of the wind. It was, he knew, customary at St. Anselm's to keep silent after Compline, and, although he had little sympathy with the convention, he wasn't anxious to be seen flouting it. There was, he knew, a television set in the ordnance sitting room, but the Saturday programs were never much good, and he was reluctant to disturb the calm.
but he could probably find a book there, and there could be no objection to his watching the late ITV news. When he opened the door, however, he saw that the room was occupied. The youngish man who had been introduced to him at lunch as Clive Stannard was watching a film, and turning at his entrance seemed to resent the intrusion. The archdeacon hovered for a moment, then said a brief good night, let himself out through the door beside the cellar steps, and battled his way across the courtyard to Augustine. By 10:40 he was in his pyjamas and dressing gown and ready for bed. He had read a chapter of St. Mark's Gospel and said his usual prayers. But tonight both had been no more than a routine exercise in conventional piety. He knew the words of Scripture by heart and had silently mouthed them, as if by slowness and careful attention to each word he could extract from them some meaning previously withheld. Taking off his dressing gown, he made sure that the window was secure against the storm and climbed into bed. Memory is best held at bay by action. Now, lying rigidly between taut sheets, hearing the howling of the wind, he knew that sleep wouldn't come easily. The crowded and traumatic day had left his mind overstimulated. Perhaps he should have battled against the wind and taken his walk. He thought about the homily, but with satisfaction rather than regret. He had prepared it with care and delivered it quietly but with passion and authority. These things had to be said, and he had said them. And if the homily had further antagonized Sebastian Morel, if distress and dislike had hardened into enmity, well, that couldn't be helped. It wasn't, he told himself, that he courted unpopularity. It was important to him to stand well with people he respected. He was ambitious, and he knew that a bishop's mitre wasn't won by antagonizing a significant section of the church, even if its influence was less powerful than once it had seemed. But Sebastian Morel was no longer as influential as he imagined. In this battle he could be sure that he was on the winning side. But there were, he reminded himself, battles of principles which had to be fought if the Church of England was to survive to serve the new millennium. Closing St. Anselm's might be only a minor skirmish in that war, but it was one which would give him satisfaction to win. So what was it, then, that he found so unsettling about St. Anselm's? Why should he feel that here, on this windswept, desolate coast, the spiritual life had to be lived at a greater intensity than elsewhere, that he and his whole past were under judgment? It wasn't as if St. Anselm's had a long history of devotion and worship. Certainly the church was medieval. One could, he supposed, hear in that silent air the echo of centuries of plainsong, although it had never been apparent to him. For him, a church was functional, a building for worship, not a place of worship. St. Anselm's was only the creation of a Victorian spinster with too much money, too little sense, and a taste for lace-trimmed albs, berettas, and bachelor priests. Probably the woman had been half mad. It was ridiculous that her pernicious influence should still govern a 21st-century college. He shifted his legs vigorously in an attempt to loosen the constricting sheet. He wished suddenly that Muriel were with him, that he could turn to her solid, comfortable body and accepting arms for the temporary oblivion of sex. But even as in thought he reached for her, there came between them, as so often in the marital bed, the memory of that other body, arms delicate as a child's, the pointed breasts, the open, exploring mouth moving over his body. You like this? And this? And this? Their love had been a mistake from the beginning, ill-advised and so predictably disastrous that he wondered now how he had been so self-deceived. The affair had been the stuff of cheap romantic fiction. It had even begun in the setting of much cheap romantic fiction, a cruise ship in the Mediterranean. A clerical acquaintance who was booked as a guest lecturer on a voyage to archaeological and historical sites in Italy and Asia
had fallen ill at the last minute and had suggested him as a substitute. He suspected that the organizers wouldn't have taken him if a better qualified candidate had been available. But he had been surprisingly successful. Luckily, on his cruise, there had been no knowledgeable academics among the passengers. By conscientious preliminary preparation and by taking with him the best written guides, he had managed to keep ahead of the other passengers. Barbara had been on board, taking an educational cruise with her mother and stepfather. She was the youngest passenger, and he wasn't the only male to be enchanted with her. To him, she had looked more like a child than a 19-year-old, and a child born out of her own time. The coal-black hair cut in a bob, with a low fringe over immense blue eyes, the heart-shaped face and small, full lips, the boyish figure, emphasized by the very short cotton shifts she chose to wear, gave her a look of the 1920s. The older passengers, who had lived through the 30s and had a folk memory of that earlier frenetic decade, sighed nostalgically and murmured that she reminded them of the young Claudette Colbert. For him, the image was false. She had no film star sophistication, only a childish innocence and gaiety and a vulnerability that enabled him to interpret sexual desire as the need to cherish and protect. He couldn't believe his luck when she singled him out for the distinction of her favor and thereafter attached herself to him with proprietorial dedication. Within 3 months they were married. He was 39, she was just 20. Educated at a succession of schools dedicated to the religion of multiculturalism and liberal orthodoxy, she knew nothing about the church, but was avid for information and instruction. Only later did he realize that the relationship between teacher and taught was for her deeply erotic. She liked to be mastered, and not only physically. But none of her enthusiasms lasted, including her enthusiasm for marriage. The church where he was then vicar had sold off the large Victorian vicarage and built in its grounds a modern two-story house of no architectural merit, but economical to run. It was not the house she had expected. Extravagant, willful, capricious, she was, he early realized, the antithesis of a suitable wife for an ambitious Church of England clergyman. Even the sex became overlaid with anxiety. She was at her most demanding when he was overtired, or on the rare occasions when they had overnight visitors, and he would become uncomfortably aware of the thinness of the bedroom walls as she murmured endearments which could so easily rise to shouted taunts and demands. At breakfast the next morning she would appear in her dressing gown, openly flirtatious, lifting her arms so that the thin silk fell away, sleepy-eyed and triumphant. Why had she married him? For security. To get away from the mother and stepfather she hated. To be cosseted, cared for, indulged. To feel safe. To be loved. He grew to dread her unpredictable moods, her outbreaks of screaming fury. He tried to shield them from the knowledge of the parish, but soon the whispers came back to him. He remembered with burning embarrassment and resentment the visit of one of his church wardens who happened to be a doctor. "Your wife isn't my patient, of course, Vicar, and I don't want to interfere, but she isn't well. I think you should try to get professional help." But when he suggested that she might see a psychiatrist or even a general practitioner, he was greeted with sobbing accusations that he was trying to get rid of her, to have her put away. Outside, the wind, which for a few minutes had dropped in intensity, rose again to a howling crescendo. Usually he enjoyed listening to its fury from the safety of his bed. Now, this small and functional room seemed less a sanctuary than a prison. Since Barbara's death, he had prayed for forgiveness for marrying her, for failing her in love and understanding. He had never asked for forgiveness for wishing her dead. Now, lying in this narrow bed, he began painfully to confront the past.
It was not an act of will that drew back the bolts of that dark dungeon to which he had consigned his marriage. The visions that rose to pass through his mind were not of his choosing. Something, that traumatic encounter with Yarwood, this place, St. Anselm's, worked to ensure that he had no alternative. Caught between a dream and a nightmare, he imagined himself in an interrogation room, modern, functional, characterless. And then he realized that it was the living room of his old vicarage. He was seated on the sofa between Dalgleish and Yarwood. They hadn't handcuffed him, not yet, but he knew that he had already been judged and found guilty, that they had all the evidence they needed. It rolled before his eyes in a grainy, secretly filmed indictment. From time to time, Dalgleish would say, "Stop there," and Yarwood would put out a hand. The image would be fixed while they viewed it in an accusing silence. All the petty transgressions and unkindnesses, as well as the major failure in love, passed before his eyes. And now at last they were viewing the final reel, the heart of darkness. He was no longer squashed down on the sofa, imprisoned between his two accusers. He had moved into the frame to reenact every movement, every word, to experience every emotion as if for the first time. It had been the late afternoon of a sunless day in mid-October. A thin rain, fine as a mist, had been falling continuously for the last 2 days from a gunmetal sky. He had returned from 2 hours of visiting long-term sick and housebound parishioners. As always, he had tried conscientiously to meet their individual and predictable needs. Blind Mrs. Oliver, who liked him to read a passage of scripture and pray with her, old Sam Possinger, who on every visit refought the Battle of Alamein, Mrs. Poley, caged in her Zimmer frame, avid for the latest parish gossip, Carl Lomas, who had never set foot in St. Botolph's, but liked discussing theology and the defects of the Church of England. Mrs. Poley, with his help, had edged her way painfully into the kitchen and made tea, taking from the tin the gingerbread cake she had baked for him. He had unwisely praised it 4 years ago on his first visit, and was now condemned to eat it weekly, finding it impossible to admit that he disliked gingerbread. But the tea, hot and strong, had been welcome, and would save him the trouble of making it at home. He parked his Vauxhall Cavalier in the road and walked to his front door, down the concrete path which dissected the spongy, saturated lawn on which decaying rose petals were dissolving into the unmown grass. The house was totally silent, and he entered, as always, with apprehension. Barbara had been sullen and fidgety at breakfast, and the restlessness and the fact that she hadn't bothered to dress were always a bad sign. At their lunch of soup from a carton, followed by a salad, still in her dressing gown, she had pushed her plate away, saying that she was too tired to eat. She would go to bed for the afternoon and try to sleep. She had said petulantly, "You'd better go to your boring old parishioners. They're all you care about anyway. Don't disturb me when you get back. I don't want to hear about them. I don't want to hear about anything." He had not replied, but had watched with a surge of anger and helplessness as slowly she mounted the stairs, the silk belt of her dressing gown trailing, her head drooping, as if in an agony of despair. Now, returning home and burdened with apprehension, he closed the front door behind him. Was she still in bed, or had she waited for him to leave, then dressed and gone out on one of her destructive and humiliating insurgencies into the parish? He had to know. He mounted the stairs quietly. If she were asleep, he had no wish to wake her. The door to the bedroom was shut, and he turned the doorknob gently. The room was in semi-darkness, the curtains partly drawn across the one long window which gave a view of the rectangle of grass, rough as a field, the triangular beds which were the garden, and beyond to the rows of neat, identical houses. He moved towards the bed and, as his eyes adjusted to the half-light, saw her clearly. She was lying on her right side, her hand curled against her cheek. The left arm was flung out over the bedclothes.
Bending down, he could hear her breathing, low and labored, could smell the wine on her breath, and a stronger, sweet, disagreeable stink which he identified as vomit. On the bedside table was a bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon. Beside it, lying on its side, and with the screw cap rolled a little apart, was a large empty bottle which he recognized. It had contained tablets of soluble aspirin. He told himself that she was asleep, that she was drunk, that she needed to be left undisturbed. Almost instinctively, he picked up the wine bottle and was about to judge how much she had drunk when something as strong as a warning voice made him put it down again. He saw that there was a handkerchief protruding from beneath the pillow. Taking it, he wiped the bottle clean, then dropped the handkerchief on the bed. It seemed to him that his actions were as without volition as they were without sense. Then he left her, closing the door behind him, and went downstairs. He told himself again, "She's asleep. She's drunk. She won't want to be disturbed." After half an hour, he went to his study, calmly got the papers together for the 6 o'clock meeting of the parochial church council, and left the house. He had no mental picture, no memory of the PCC meeting, but he could remember driving home with Melvin Hopkins, one of the church wardens. He had promised Melvin to let him have a sight of the latest report of the church's Committee on Social Responsibility, and had suggested that Melvin accompany him to the vicarage. And now the sequence of images was clear again. Himself apologizing for the fact that Barbara wasn't there, and telling Melvin that she had been unwell. Going up again to the bedroom, and again gently opening the door, seeing in the half-light the still figure, the wine bottle, the bottle of pills on its side. He went over to the bed. This time there was no low, raucous breathing. Putting out his hand to her cheek, he found that it was cold, and knew that what he was touching was death. And then there came a memory, words heard or read from some forgotten source, but now terrifying in their implication. It was always wise to have someone with you when you found the body. He couldn't relive the events of the church funeral service or the cremation. He had no memory of either. In their place was a jumble of faces, sympathetic, concerned, frankly anxious, zooming at him out of darkness, distorted and grotesque. And now there was that one dreaded face. He was sitting on the sofa again, but this time with Sergeant Yarwood, and a young uniformed boy who looked no older than one of his boy choristers and who sat silent throughout the interrogation. "And when you returned to the house from visiting your parishioners shortly after 5, you say, what exactly did you do, sir?" "I've told you, Sergeant. I went up to the bedroom to see if my wife was still sleeping. When you opened the door, was the bedside lamp on?" "No, it wasn't. The curtains were almost completely drawn and the room was in semi-darkness." "Did you go up to the body?" "I've told you, Sergeant. I just looked in, saw that my wife was still in bed and assumed that she was asleep." "And she went to bed, when was that?" "At lunchtime, I suppose about 12:30. She said she wasn't hungry and she was going to have a sleep." "Didn't you think it strange that she should still be sleeping after 5 hours? "No, I didn't. She said that she was tired. My wife often did sleep in the afternoons." "Didn't it occur to you that she might be ill? Didn't it occur to you to go up to the bed and make sure that she was all right? Didn't you realize that she might urgently need a doctor?" "I've told you. I'm tired of telling you. I thought she was asleep." "Did you see the two bottles on the bedside table? The wine and the soluble aspirin?" "I saw the wine bottle. I guessed my wife had been drinking." "Did she take the bottle of wine up to bed with her?" "No, she didn't. She must have come down for it after I left the house." "And carried it up to bed with her?" "I suppose so. There was no one else in the house. Of course she took it to bed with her. How else could it have got on the bedside table?" "Well, that's the question, isn't it, sir? You see, there were no fingerprints on the wine bottle. Can you explain how that could be?" "Of course I can't. I assume she wiped them off. There was a handkerchief half under the pillow." "Which you were able to see, although you couldn't see the upturned bottle?"
Not at the time. I saw it later, when I found her body.
And so the questions went on. Yarwood returned time and time again, sometimes with the young uniformed constable, but sometimes on his own. Crampton came to dread every ring at the door and could hardly bear to look out of the windows in case he saw that grey-coated figure moving resolutely up the path. The questions were always the same, and his answers became unconvincing even to his own ears. Even after the inquest and the expected verdict of suicide, the persecution continued. Barbara had been cremated weeks before. There was nothing left of her but a few handfuls of ground bones buried in a corner of the churchyard, and still Yarwood continued his inquiries. Never had Nemesis arrived in a less personable form. Yarwood looked like a doorstep salesman, doggedly persistent, inured to rejection, carrying with him like halitosis the taint of failure. He was slightly built, surely only just tall enough to qualify for the police, sallow-skinned and with a high bony forehead and dark, secretive eyes. He seldom looked directly at Crampton during the questioning, but focused on the middle distance, as if communing with an internal controller. His voice never varied from a monotone, and the silence between the questions was pregnant with a menace which seemed to embrace more than his victim. He seldom gave notice of his coming, but seemed to know when Crampton was at home, and would wait with apparently docile patience at the front door until silently ushered in. There were never any preliminaries, only the insistent questions. "Would you say it was a happy marriage, sir?" The impertinence of it shocked Crampton into silence. Then he found himself replying in a voice of such harshness that he could hardly recognize it. "I suppose that for the police every relationship, even the most sacred, can be classified. You should hand out a marriage questionnaire. It would save everyone time. Tick the appropriate box. Very happy, happy, reasonably happy, a little unhappy, unhappy, very unhappy, murderous." There was a silence. Then Yarwood said, "And which box would you tick, sir?" In the end, Crampton made a formal complaint to the chief constable and the visit ceased. He was told that after the inquiry it was accepted that Sergeant Yarwood had exceeded his authority, particularly in arriving alone and pursuing an investigation which had not been authorized. He remained in Crampton's memory as a dark, accusing figure. Time, the new parish, his appointment to archdeacon, his second marriage, nothing could assuage the burning anger which consumed him whenever he thought of Yarwood. And now today the man had appeared again. He couldn't remember what exactly they had said to each other. He only knew that his own resentment and bitterness had been poured out in a torrent of angry vituperation. He had prayed, at first regularly and then intermittently since Barbara's death, asking forgiveness for his sins against her. Impatience, intolerance, lack of love, failure to understand or to forgive. But the sin of wishing her dead had never been allowed to take root in his mind, and he had received his absolution to the lesser sin of neglect. It had come in the words of Barbara's general practitioner when they had met just before the inquest. "One thing has been on my mind. If I'd realized when I came home that Barbara wasn't asleep, that she was in a coma and had called for an ambulance, would it have made any difference?" He had received the absolving reply, "With the quantity she had taken and drunk, none at all." What was there about this place that forced him to confront the greater as well as the lesser lies? He had known she was in danger of death. He had hoped that she would die. He was, in the eyes of his God, surely as guilty of murder as if he had dissolved those tablets and forced them down her throat, as if he had held the glass of wine to her lips. How could he continue to minister to others, to preach the forgiveness of sins, when his own great sin was unacknowledged? How could he have stood up before that congregation tonight with this darkness in his soul? He put out his hand and switched on the bedside lamp. It flooded the room with light, surely brighter than when, by that gentle glow, he had read his evening passage of Scripture. He got out of bed and knelt, burying his head in his hands. It wasn't necessary to search for the words. They came to him naturally, and with them came the promise of forgiveness and peace. Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner.
It was while he was kneeling there that his mobile telephone on the bedside table broke the silence with its cheerfully incongruous tune. The sound was so unexpected, so discordant, that for 5 seconds he didn't recognize it. Then he got stiffly to his feet and put out his hand to answer the call. 2. Shortly before 5:30, Father Martin woke himself with a shriek of terror. He jerked up in bed and sat rigid as a doll, staring wild-eyed into the darkness. Beads of sweat ran down his forehead and stung his eyes. Brushing them away, he felt his skin taut and ice-cold, as if already in the rigor of death. Gradually, as the horror of the nightmare ended, the room took shape around him. Grey forms, more imagined than seen, revealed themselves out of darkness and became comfortingly familiar. A chair, the chest of drawers, the footboard of his bed, the outline of a picture frame. The curtains over the 4 circular windows were drawn, but from the east he could see a thin sliver of the faint light which even on the darkest night hovered above the sea. He was aware of the storm. The wind had been rising all evening, and by the time he had composed himself for sleep, it was howling round the tower like a banshee. But now there was a lull, more ominous than welcome, and sitting up rigidly, he listened to the silence. He heard no footfall on the stairs, no calling voice. When the nightmares began 2 years earlier, he had asked to be given the small circular room in the southern tower, explaining that he liked the wide view of the sea and coast and was attracted by the silence and solitude. The stairs were becoming a tedious climb, but at least he could hope that his waking screams would be unheard. But somehow Father Sebastian had guessed the truth, or part of it. Father Martin remembered their brief conversation one Sunday after Mass. Father Sebastian had said, "Are you sleeping well, Father?"
"Reasonably so, thank you."
"If you are disturbed by bad dreams, I understand there is help available. I'm not thinking of counseling, not in the ordinary sense, but sometimes talking about the past with others who've suffered the same experience is said to be helpful." The conversation had surprised Father Martin. Father Sebastian had made no secret of his distrust of psychiatrists, saying that he would be more inclined to respect them if they could explain the medical or philosophical basis of their discipline, or could define for him the difference between the mind and the brain. But it had always surprised him how much Father Sebastian knew about what was going on under the roof of St. Anselm's. The conversation had been unwelcome to Father Martin, the matter not pursued. He knew that he was not the only survivor of a Japanese prison camp who was being tormented in old age by horrors which a younger brain had been able to suppress. He had no wish to sit in a circle discussing his experiences with fellow sufferers, although he had read that some found it helpful. This was something he had to deal with himself. And now the wind was rising, a rhythmic moaning that rose to a howling and then screeching intensity, more a malignant manifestation than a force of nature. He urged his legs out of bed, pushed his feet into his bedroom slippers and pottered stiffly over to open the east-facing window. The cold blast was like a healing draught, cleaning his mouth and nostrils of the fetid stench of the jungle, drowning the all-too-human moans and screams with its wild cacophony, cleansing his mind of the worst of the images. The nightmare was always the same. Rupert had been dragged back to the camp the night before, and now the prisoners were lined up to watch his beheading. After what had been done to him, the boy could hardly walk to the appointed place, and sank to his knees as if with relief. But he made a last effort, and managed to raise his head before the blade swung down. For 2 seconds, the head remained in place. Then slowly it toppled, and the great red fountain spurted out like a last celebration of life. This was the image which night after night Father Martin endured.
On waking, he was tortured always by the same questions. Why had Rupert tried to escape when he must have known it was suicide? Why hadn't he confided his purpose? Worst of all, why hadn't he himself stepped forward in protest before the blade fell, tried with his frail strength to seize it from the guard, and died with his friend? The love he had felt for Rupert, requited but unconsummated, had been the only love of his life. All else had been the exercise of a general benevolence or the practice of loving kindness. Despite the moments of joy, some even of a rare spiritual happiness, he carried always the darkness of that betrayal. He had no right to be alive, but there was one place where he could always find peace, and he sought it now. He took his bunch of keys from the bedside table, shuffled over to the hook on the door, and took down his old cardigan with the patches of leather on the elbows, which he wore in winter under his cloak. He put the cloak over it, quietly opened the door, and made his way down the stairs. He needed no torch. A low light from a single bulb burned on each landing, and the spiral staircase to the floor below, always a hazard, was kept well lit by the use of wall-mounted lights. There was a lull in the storm. The silence of the house was absolute, the muted moaning of the wind emphasizing an internal calm more portentous than the mere absence of human sounds. It was difficult to believe that there were sleepers behind the closed doors, that this silent air had ever echoed to the sound of hurrying feet and strong male voices, or that the heavy oak front door had not been closed and bolted for generations. In the hall, a single red light at the foot of the Virgin and Child cast a glow over the smiling face of the mother and touched with pink the chubby outstretched arms of the Christ Child. Wood was quickened into living flesh. He passed on his silent slippered feet across the hall and into the cloakroom. The row of brown cloaks were the first evidence of the house's occupation. They seemed to hang like forlorn relics of a long-dead generation. He could hear the wind very clearly now, and as he unlocked the door into the north cloister, it rose suddenly into renewed fury. To his surprise, the light over the back door was off, as was the row of low